Imagine spending like $10,000 on this gorgeous new landing page, right? And you hire this top-tier copywriter to craft this intricate email sequence, and you finally hit launch on a major campaign.
Only to watch your conversion rate sit at a flat, agonizing zero.
Exactly, a total zero. And your immediate instinct is just to panic, you know? You want to blame the algorithm or your ad spend or, I don't know, maybe the button color?
Oh, it's always the button color.
Always. But today, we're diving into a really fascinating stack of strategy notes titled The Brief is a Promise: What Happens When You Break It? And these notes prove that your campaign didn't actually fail on launch day. It failed like 4 weeks ago.
Yeah, in a document you probably spent 10 minutes writing.
Right. So we are on a mission today for this deep dive. We're uncovering the hidden root cause of why projects, specifically your marketing campaigns, completely fall apart, even when every individual piece of that project looks perfectly fine on its own.
Which is such a brilliant focus for a deep dive, honestly. Primarily because the title of these notes, it frames the brief not as just some piece of administrative paperwork, but as a rigid commitment, a promise.
Yeah, a promise. I love that.
And the core premise we're looking at really strikes at the heart of how most small and medium business owners actually operate in the real world.
The SMBs.
Right. The source material points out that most SMB owners treat the campaign brief as this low-stakes starting point.
Just a rough draft.
Exactly. They view it as a rough sketch, like a general vibe check, really, that they can just naturally refine as they get their hands dirty in the actual creative work.
And honestly, if you're a busy founder or a marketer, that instinct makes a lot of sense. You want to get to the tangible output.
Right, you want to see the product.
Yeah. I mean, the brief feels like eating your vegetables before you get to the dessert of designing a slick landing page, right?
Oh, 100%.
So you just sort of jot down some general ideas. You figure you have the gist of the campaign in your head, and you just assume the finer details will organically iron themselves out once the design phase kicks off.
It is a totally natural instinct to want to jump to the finish line. But the source makes this really compelling case for why this specific assumption is so dangerous.
Dangerous how?
Well, treating the brief as a low-stakes starting point is the exact mechanism of failure. When a brief is bad, nothing coheres downstream.
Nothing at all.
Right? The landing page might look stunning in a vacuum, the email copy might be incredibly punchy on its own, and the social media graphics might be objectively beautiful.
But they don't match.
Exactly. When you put them all together, they end up sounding like they belong to three completely different campaigns. The call to action on the web page suddenly creates friction with the emotional promise that was made in the initial advertisement. The assets literally cannot talk to each other.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to really understand why these assets break apart despite looking good, we have to completely redefine what a brief actually is, you
We
know?
really do.
We need to stop looking at it as a description of a thing. Treating a brief like a description is like giving a builder a blueprint that just says, a house with doors.
Huh, right. A house with doors.
Like you haven't made any actual choices. Or think of it like giving three different brilliant musicians a piece of sheet music that just says, play something jazzy.
That is a great way to put it.
You haven't made any actual choices about tempo or key or structure. They might all be incredible musicians individually, but when they get on stage together and start playing their own assumptions of what jazzy means.
You aren't going to get a song. You're going to get a car crash of noise.
Exactly, a car crash of noise.
That analogy gets right to the heart of the issue. The source material points out something really counterintuitive here, which is that a blank brief isn't actually the problem.
Wait, really? A blank brief isn't the problem.
No, because a blank piece of paper is obviously incomplete. If you hand those musicians a blank page, they know they can't start playing yet.
Oh, I see.
The real insidious danger is the brief that gives the illusion of being complete. It's the brief overflowing with industry buzzwords that feel substantial but contain absolutely zero constraints.
Oh man, the buzzwords. We all know them. And if we're being completely honest, we have all leaned on them when we were in a rush.
Oh, definitely.
Words like, you know, decision makers or quality conscious consumers or growth focused teams.
They sound great on paper.
Right, they take up space on the page, they sound incredibly professional, but they don't actually dictate a single hard choice.
And that is the trap. If a brief simply says, "We sell project management software for growth-focused small businesses," it has made zero strategic decisions.
Nero.
A functional brief must answer difficult, highly constrained questions. Who exactly is the audience, down to their psychological state. What do they currently believe about project management that this specific product needs to actively disrupt? And what is the one specific piece of evidence they must trust before they'll take out their credit card?
Wait, let me pause you there. The text uses a term that caught my eye regarding this. It's called surface confidence.
Ah, yes, surface confidence.
It says these buzzword-heavy briefs produce assets with high surface confidence but zero internal consistency. What is the actual mechanism there? Because if something looks confident and professional, shouldn't it work?
What's fascinating here is how our brains process professional aesthetics. Surface confidence just means the output looks polished enough that nobody questions the underlying logic.
Oh, so it just looks the part.
Right. So imagine your email copywriter reads the phrase growth-focused teams in your brief. They interpret that through their own lens and imagine a scrappy, fast-moving tech startup of maybe five people.
Okay, yeah.
So they write an email that is aggressive, it's casual, it's highly energetic. The email reads beautifully, has surface confidence.
So the copywriter did a great job based on their specific assumption.
Precisely. But meanwhile, your landing page designer reads that exact same phrase, growth-focused teams, and their brain assumes you mean a rigid corporate department of 50 people trying to scale.
Oh, wow. I see where this is going.
Yeah, so they design a page with muted blue tones, highly structured corporate grids, and serious data-driven imagery.
Which also looks amazing.
Right. The page is gorgeous. It also has surface confidence. Both creators produce professional work based on their own localized assumptions.
That they don't match at all.
Exactly. The moment a customer clicks that aggressive, casual email and lands on that sterile corporate web page, the psychological dissonance is immediate. The internal consistency is zero, and the conversion is totally lost.
And because these assets have that surface confidence, the lack of alignment is completely invisible to the team at first glance.
Right. Everyone thinks they're doing a great job.
Everyone's high-fiving, but the errors are mutating as they move down the production line. Which brings us to a concept in the notes that absolutely blew my mind. The math of compounding errors.
Yes, the snowball effect.
There is an actual snowball effect to this ambiguity.
And it is a mathematical progression of failure that explains why campaigns feel so disconnected by launch day.
I want to walk through that math because it is terrifying. The source actually breaks down this specific chain reaction. Let's say you have just, I don't know, a 10% ambiguity in your initial brief.
Which is incredibly common, by the way.
Oh, totally. You were just a little fuzzy on the edges of who you were talking to. Well, that 10% ambiguity forces the first strategist to fill in the blanks.
Right. They have to guess.
Exactly. Which multiplies into a 20% ambiguity in how the audience is framed. Then the designer takes that 20% skewed framing and adds their own visual interpretations.
To fill in those remaining gaps.
Yeah. Ballooning the error into a 40% tonal mismatch in the final copywriting and design, by the time you get to the end of the line, you have landing page sections that literally read like they were written for entirely different human beings.
And we really need to explain why that multiplication happens. It happens because every handoff in a creative process is a translation exercise.
A translation exercise, yeah.
If the brief leaves a gap, human nature abhors a vacuum. The creator will subconsciously invent context to fill that gap just so they can finish their task.
They just want to get the work done.
Right. And then the next person in the chain doesn't read the original brief. They read the invented context of the person before them, and then they add their own assumptions on top of it.
Oh, man. So it just builds and builds.
Exactly. The error doesn't just pass along a flat line. It compounds exponentially with every new set of hands.
But wait, what if there are no handoffs? Because I know a lot of the listeners right now are thinking, look, I don't have an agency. I don't have a copywriter and a designer passing things back and forth. It's just me.
Well, the source material addresses this directly. And the reality is actually much harsher for the solo operator.
Really? How so?
Because if you're in a large agency, maybe different departments are making these conflicting assumptions. But if you're doing it all yourself, you are the one writing the brief on Monday, building the landing page on Wednesday, and writing the email sequence on Friday.
So you essentially play a game of telephone with yourself.
That is exactly the mechanism. Because you are working across multiple days in completely different psychological states with different immediate micro goals, you will subconsciously reinterpret your own vague brief differently in every single session.
That makes so much sense.
Right. On Monday, when you're feeling strategic, quality-conscious consumers meant people who care about long-term durability.
Mm-hmm.
But on Friday, when you're exhausted and just trying to get an email out the door before the weekend, quality-conscious consumers suddenly shifts in your mind to mean people who want luxury packaging. You become entirely out of sync with your own past intentions.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. We can clearly see how this translation error multiplies, but we need to look at exactly where it causes the most expensive, catastrophic damage in a campaign.
Yes. The two main failure points.
Right. The source points directly to two specific areas, the audience definition and the call to action. Let's start with the audience definition because the contrast provided in the notes really exposes how lazy we can be.
It's a great example.
They compare a standard, bland audience definition like small business owners to a hyper-specific one, like service-based business owners who've tried running Facebook ads before and given up.
Consider the immense difference in the gravitational pull of those two descriptions. Small business owners is merely a demographic category. It tells you absolutely nothing about the friction preventing a sale.
Nothing at all. It could be anyone.
Exactly. But service-based business owners who've tried running Facebook ads before and given up, that is a deeply behavioral profile. It is laden with historical context, emotional baggage, and a very specific pain point.
Yeah, you instantly know what they're afraid of.
Right. If your brief does not commit to a specific segment's past behaviors and current worries, your audience simulation is forced to guess.
And when you say audience simulation, you mean the process of putting yourself in the shoes of the buyer to figure out what they want. But the text mentions this isn't just human strategists anymore, right? It brings up AI tools.
Yes. The source specifically mentions Dayclerk's behavioral simulation. Now, think about how an AI analysis tool actually works. It ingests your brief and runs a simulation against vast data sets to analyze potential friction points.
Like the psychological barrier stopping them from buying.
Exactly. But if you feed that algorithm, the vague phrase small business owners, the AI is forced to hallucinate an average.
Oh, an average.
It has to simulate this chimera that is part freelance graphic designer, part fleet-owning plumber, and part tech startup. The output it gives you will be generic, smoothed over garbage.
Because it's trying to solve problems for a person who literally does not exist.
Precisely. By failing to constrain the audience, you force the simulation, whether human or machine, to guess. And that guesswork fundamentally breaks your ability to diagnose why people aren't buying.
Which flows perfectly into the second most expensive point of failure, the call to action. The CTA illusion.
Oh, the CTA illusion.
I cannot tell you how many times I have been in this exact frustrating scenario, and I know you, listening to this, have too. You launch the campaign, the traffic is glowing, people are visiting the page, but nobody is clicking the button.
Crickets.
The conversion rate is zero, and our immediate, desperate instinct is to localize the problem. We assume the button itself is broken.
So we rewrite it.
Right. We change buy now to learn more. We change the button color from blue to this high visibility orange. We just endlessly A-B test the ship of the button.
It is the most common, expensive trap in digital marketing. We obsess over the final millimeter of the journey while completely ignoring the mile that came before it.
Yeah, ignoring the mile before it. That's a great way to say it.
A failing CTA is almost always a brief problem in disguise. Think about the psychological state of the user at the exact moment their mouse hovers over that button.
They're hesitating.
Right. If they aren't clicking, it isn't because the button is the wrong shade of orange. It means the copy upstream, the headlines, the emails, the body text failed to build the correct emotional and logical expectations.
It's that dissonance again.
Yes. And why did that upstream copy fail to align with the button? Because the brief itself was completely unclear about what specific action the audience was actually ready to take and what specific proof they needed to see before taking it.
It's like you're trying to fix a crumbling foundation by repainting the front door.
That is exactly what it is.
Okay, I understand the logic completely, but I have to push back here.
Sure, go ahead.
Because I've worked with a lot of highly talented creatives, and if you hand them a brief that locks down every single microscopic detail of the audience's psychology and the exact proof points to be used, they're going to push back hard.
Oh, they definitely will.
Right. Isn't there a very real risk of choking the life out of a campaign? Like, if I constrain everything, aren't I just forcing a strategist or an AI tool to essentially self-plagiarize? Doesn't a looser, more open brief leave room for that unexpected creative magic to happen in the flow of the work?
This raises an important question, and the tension you're describing is a very real debate in the industry. The source material doesn't shy away from it. Overconstrained briefs absolutely can produce campaigns that are technically consistent but creatively dead.
Right, just boring.
Exactly. If a brief is so rigid that it dictates every adjective and every font choice, you completely lose the spark of human ingenuity. However, and this is the vital counterargument presented in the text, creative latitude only works when the person exercising it operates within a fully realized context.
So freedom needs boundaries, but why do we resist setting those boundaries so much?
This is where we get into the psychology of the marketer. The profound realization from the text is a concept we can call the deferral of choice.
The deferral of choice.
Yes. When a solo operator or a marketing director leaves a brief vague, they tell themselves a very comforting lie. They tell themselves they're creating creative space.
Like they're leaving room for magic.
Right. But in reality, they're simply deferring hard decisions because making decisions is deeply uncomfortable.
Because deciding means committing. It means cutting off other possibilities.
Exactly, the mechanism. Deciding exactly who you are targeting means actively deciding who you are ignoring. And marketers are terrified of leaving money on the table.
Oh, always. They think, what if I target only frustrated service businesses and then a retail business wants to buy?
Right. So they widen the net, they use buzzwords, they leave it vague. They aren't creating freedom. They're just procrastinating on making a definitive choice.
They just push it down the line.
Exactly. They push that difficult decision onto the plate of the copywriter or the designer or their future self at 11 p.m. on a Friday. And by pushing the decision downstream, they guarantee the campaign will fracture.
So what does this all mean? How do you actually balance this tension?
It's the big question.
Yeah, how do you get that tight 100% cohesion so your landing page and your emails actually match without choking the creative process by micromanaging every single word?
The source provides a very clear structural fix for this.
Okay.
You have to change what the brief is fundamentally supposed to be. You have to stop treating the brief as a static description of what you want to build and start treating it as a scientific hypothesis about your audience.
Oh, a hypothesis. That's a massive paradigm shift.
It is. A description is static and boring. A hypothesis is dynamic, it's testable, and it's deeply engaging for a creative team. Mm-hmm. The source lays out an exact fill-in-the-blank formula for this hypothesis, and its brilliance lies in its absolute demand for specificity.
What's the formula?
It goes like this. We believe that insert specific person here is struggling with insert specific friction.
Okay.
And that if we can show them insert specific proof, they will take insert specific action.
Oh, I want to break down why that acts as such a powerful forced function. Let's plug our earlier example into it. We believe that specific person. So we aren't allowed to just say small business owners.
Right, you can't.
We are forced to say service-based business owners who game up on Facebook ads.
Exactly.
And then is struggling with specific friction. We have to define the emotional barrier. So maybe the friction is that they feel like digital marketing is a black hole that just drains their limited cash.
That's a very real friction.
Right. And that if we can show them specific proof, this is the crucial part, the proof can't just be our software is great.
No, it has to answer the friction.
Yeah, the proof has to directly answer the friction. So maybe the specific proof is a transparent case study showing the exact return on ad spend for a plumbing company.
Brilliant.
And finally, they will take specific action, which dictates exactly what that CTA button needs to be. It shouldn't be learn more. It should be read the plumbing case study.
Do you see how that structure fundamentally changes the creative sandbox?
It totally does.
You cannot complete that sentence with buzzwords. It physically forces you to make the hard, structural decisions before a single asset gets built. It defines the rigid boundaries of the sandbox. The audience, the friction, the proof, the action.
But it leaves the creative team completely free to decide how to build the castle inside that sandbox.
Exactly. The copywriter can still use their unique voice. The designer can still invent brilliant visual metaphors.
But most importantly, it completely eliminates that compounding 40% tonal mismatch we talked about earlier.
Because the context is locked.
Yeah, because it doesn't matter if the designer is working on a Tuesday in a great mood and the copywriter is grinding on a Thursday feeling cynical. They are both trying to prove the exact same highly specific hypothesis.
They're both looking at the exact same proof and driving toward the exact same action.
Right. The brief is no longer a loose suggestion. It is the unified true north for the entire production line.
It completely removes the need for anyone down the line to guess or invent context. Only the execution is fluid.
This has been such a revealing look at the unseen mechanics of why things break down. But before we wrap up, the source material leaves us with a highly practical tool you can use immediately today.
Yes, the read aloud test.
The read aloud test. Before you launch your next campaign, or before you even hand off your next brief to a team member or feed it into an AI tool, you need to read it out loud to yourself and ask a very tough, uncompromising question.
That's a great test.
If a complete stranger found this document on the street and read only this, would they know exactly who is supposed to feel seen by this campaign and exactly why today is the exact right moment to reach them?
And if the answer is no?
If the answer is no, stop. Do not write the email. Do not build the page. Do not touch the CTA button. The brief isn't done yet, and the creative work can wait.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it reveals something deeply human about how we operate far beyond just marketing.
How do you mean?
Well, we spend a lot of time unpacking how a vague brief is really just a symptom of our psychological fear of committing to a hard decision. We want to keep our options open because closing doors is scary.
Oh, definitely. Committing is hard.
But consider how this brief as a hypothesis framework could expose hidden flaws in how an entire company, or even an individual, defines their core identity.
Wow.
It forces you to look at your own goals and ask, are you leaving your own company's mission, or perhaps even your own life's brief, intentionally vague and filled with comfortable buzzwords?
Just to keep things open.
Right. Are you doing that just to avoid the profound discomfort of making the hard choices about who you really are and what specific friction you're actually trying to overcome?
Man, that is a thought that is going to stick with you long after this deep dive ends. The blueprint only works if you have the courage to decide exactly what kind of house you are actually building.
Well said.
Thank you so much for joining us on this intellectual journey today. We love taking these strategy notes, unpacking the underlying mechanics, and figuring out how it all applies to the reality of the work you do every day.
It's been great.
Keep challenging your assumptions, keep seeking the full picture, and above all, keep asking the hard questions. We will see you on the next deep dive.